Spring into deals at Lowe's. Shop select 1.5-gallon annuals hanging baskets, 2 for $15, for the perfect addition to Mom's garden. Plus, get 3 free bags of Miracle-Gro 0.75 cubic foot garden soil when you buy 3. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 5/6, excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. The Justice Warrior that I'm joined with today has such a unique and layered story, and that this is a rare occasion where I actually spent some time and wrote an intro for you, Dwayne, because there's too much here for me to remember. So let me introduce Dwayne. This is Dwayne Betts. He was incarcerated as a teenager and spent nearly 9 years in prison. While inside, he discovered literature and poetry, including during time in solitary confinement, where books were treated as contraband. After his release, he went on to become a nationally recognized poet, a Yale-trained lawyer, and the founder of Freedom Reads, an organization bringing handcrafted libraries directly into prison cell blocks. His work sits at the intersection of accountability, reentry, dignity, literature, and the question of whether America truly believes that people can change. Dwayne, thank you so much. And for the listeners that recommended me to get Dwayne on, thank you guys. I just told Dwayne before we started, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a couple of weeks. Once he was recommended, I started doing a bunch of research, and what a unique journey that you've been on. So first and foremost, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you. And I also thank the listeners. I think one of the things that it is hard to come to grips with is a lot of people have stories that are worthy of being told, and most of us don't have advocates. It's really humbling to realize that those of us who do get our stories told, it's often because of people who we don't know, who are reminding others that something about our life should be heard by a larger group of people. So I really appreciate that. And this is lovely.
Yeah. And I think that these conversations, they have a much broader reach than just you and I talking and people learning your story, because it's helping people to understand. You know, our show usually focuses around wrongful convictions when we're doing our long form seasons. And just for people to understand, you know, what's going on in prisons, and that the people that are incarcerated, whether they're guilty or innocent, are real people. You know, they're human beings, and they deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And the concept of rehabilitation as opposed to retribution, all these things, I think these conversations kind of speak to a bigger issue that then carries over into those other stories.
I mean, you know, the truth is that I feel like my skill as a storyteller, and this is just what I've chosen to do in my life, but I feel like it allows me to like understand some things about the world, say some things about the world that I might not be able to say if I wasn't a storyteller. And so Even just thinking about some of the things that you just said, a friend of mine just passed away and he was innocent. You know, he did 25 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. I helped him get a lawyer with the Virginia Innocence Project, Deidre Emright. Me and Deidre went to see the chair of the parole board. And we made a case for his release after the courts had denied every habeas petition, despite the fact that it was a crooked cop who had been known to be hit crooked, despite that it was a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that he didn't do it, including somebody else confessing in a situation that was really just like Shawshank Redemption. He was able to get no relief. And then Virginia made people got convicted as juveniles eligible for parole. He became eligible for parole. He was later released after 25 years.
I think most of my listeners are probably somewhat familiar with Deidre because she played a big role in the the podcast that started all of this, the Serial podcast back in 2015 or 2014, where she was covering the Adnan Syed case.
Yeah, and me and her went down there. It was the last flight I took before the pandemic. Roger would get released from prison. He got locked up when he was 15. I mean, it was harrowing. She went and she, surveyed the jurors. And one of the jurors said that it was other jurors who said, I don't think he did it. And she said, I don't think he did it either. And some people said that, well, if he didn't do it, he probably did something else. And they found this 15-year-old kid guilty of murder. And then he did 25 years in prison. He came home and with a lot, like a lot of people, you come home to a life that you're not ready for. And then things sort of fall apart incrementally. And he ended up passing away a short time ago. But his life frames all of it because I think about that part of his life. But I think about the part of his life that had the kind of tenacity to keep demanding justice in a situation where it had been long deprived. And also you talked about rehabilitation. I mean, I fought censorship in prison. Because he asked for 12 copies of my book because he wanted to start a reentry program for the young folks. And he did for the younger men in prison. And it was around this notion that 30 minutes could change your life. And it was around looking at my memoir in chapters and using those chapters as discussion points. But when I mailed him 12 copies, they thought that he must be doing something nefarious because why would you want 12 copies of one book?
Mm-hmm.
So his work in prison actually pushed me to challenge the censorship that was going on around my book. And we succeeded, and the book was able to get into the prison. It had already been in a prison, but they were able to give him the 12 copies, and they understood why he wanted them. But the point is, his life represents a lot of the things on the spectrum of what gets discussed here around innocence, around guilt, around rehabilitation, and seriously, around friendship. Because the other part about this is that, you're not supposed to do 25 years in prison anyway. But when you do 25 years for something that you didn't do, and then you die largely because of the stuff that you inherited from prison, because of everything that prison denied you in terms of being able to adjust and acclimate and be an adult, it is just like immensely tragic. And so anyway, it's nice to be able to mention him on this podcast because, again, I had the benefit of people saying Dwayne has a story that should be told. But many of us don't have that benefit, partly because we all know that if I was locked up right now, no matter what the circumstances were, nobody would want to talk to me.
Right.
Part of people talk to me now is because of my success. I feel like I have to be successful or there is no story, which is both a conundrum and a thing that has driven me my entire life. So maybe it's also been a benefit to a boon on my existence as much as a burden.
Do you think, we're going to get into kind of the path that you went on, but I'm curious in this part of the discussion, if you had not been arrested and incarcerated when you were a teenager, what do you think your life would look like now? Do you think it would look very different? Do you think that actually ended up leading you on the path you're on now? Or do you think you would have ended up here anyway?
Yeah, I know I wouldn't have ended up here. And I could say that but just because I'm a poet and I would have never thought about being a poet had I not gone to prison. But also, I was a child. I went to prison at 16 years old. It's really hard for me to imagine a different path for myself because, Fess was 15 when he went to prison. How do you imagine who you're going to be as an adult when you're 15 years old? And I was 16. And so, what I became was both anchored to prison, but I benefited from coming home at 24 and 25, being able to go to college, being able to build a life and an identity for myself. The reality is that because so much of my formative years were spent in prison, I was never able to disconnect that life and that identity from prison.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I don't say that as a burden, though. I say it in some ways as a perverse blessing. We put millions of people in prison, and one should be so blessed to have a good fortune to care about so many people who others don't. It's like you don't think that suffering, both your own and other people, gives you a gateway to being able to feel more human and alive in the world. But in a strange way, going from 16 years old to the worst place I could imagine being, gave me a sense of self and a sense of identity that I wouldn't have otherwise had. And I rarely say shit like this because it seems so self-aggrandizing, and it seems obnoxious. But I got 6 men out of prison, and those men would have been in prison had I not gone to prison, Our relationships and the things that I've been able to do because of them actually matter. And that is what I wouldn't have been able to do without prison. I don't know who I would have been without prison, but I'm really happy with who I am, And part of happiness comes from the people who helped me become who I am. Even, unfortunately, as they have not been able to like have the kind of successes that I've had in this life.
Let's go back to 16-year-old Dwayne. Before you got into trouble, what was your life like at that point? As far as your environment, you know, family, the neighborhood, who you were hanging with. You were ultimately convicted of carjacking, for the listeners to know. But like, what led up to that? What was life looking like for you back then?
It's like, it was like, well, let me see. What was your life like? And people are thinking like, why do you want to know what he was like as a teenager? You know what you were like. And then you was like, you were ultimately convicted of carjacking.
So right.
It is funny though, right? Because it's not funny that I did a carjacking, but it's funny that you could live in a world in which the things that's in the realm of possibility for you to do includes the most foul and absurd thing imaginable.
Right.
From, you know, carjacking might not be the most foul thing, but it is something that's beyond the pale. My kid is 18 years old. My youngest son is 14. Neither one of my boys have thought about carjacking somebody. They've never pistol. They've never hung on street corners where people sell drugs. They've never been around people selling drugs. They don't have classmates who got arrested. They really don't have classmates who got murdered. All of that happened to me. And I've spent a lot of my life saying that, you know, I didn't live in the worst neighborhood, and I didn't. And yet all of those things I just said happened to me, which meant not that I was guaranteed to do it, because I still represented probably the 2%, 3%, 4%, 8% of young boys in my community who engaged in acts of violence. But it was in the realm of possibility, you know, and like I wrote in my memoir, it was realer than the college degree I imagined that I would get. And as a kid, though, I was somebody who honestly, you know, outside of my family, I really started to be loved in prison, which is a fucking perverse thing to say. But I mean, I got suspended 5 times when I was in middle school, all for talking too much. I never got in a single fight. I ain't won a fight since the 2nd grade. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, I got detention every year in the 9th grade. So much so that in the 10th grade, I went to detention just on GP because it was a way to escape the noise. And I remember 11th grade, my 10th grade person who ran detention, she was the chair of the history department. I tried to be in one of these Jeopardy classes for students, right?
Mm-hmm.
She said, Dwayne, you're going to end up dead like your friend for talking too much.
Right.
See, I lived in a neighborhood where adults would predict death on your life just because they thought that you were a smart aleck. And so for me, you'd be like, well, how did you turn a corner to end up in prison? I felt like completely and absolutely unwanted by people outside of my mom that I wanted to be desired by. I felt like I was in a space that expected absolutely nothing of me. And I just had the inability to fight through it and become somebody. So I just quit. And I've never said that, man, but going to prison is like the easiest way to quit. And I just gave up, you know, I was just like, fuck it, you know. And then I got to prison and I realized I really didn't want to quit.
Right.
I realized that I was so down low that if I became anything, it was going to be on me. And I no longer had to seek. I had no teachers to seek affirmation from. I had nobody to go to say, do you believe I'll be somebody anyway? And then I had these dudes around me who was just like, yo, Shahid is a scholar. You know what I mean? Yeah. This dude is a lawyer. You know, he be writing poems and people respected me. And they respected the fact that I had a vocabulary that extended beyond profanity, even if my profanity. And then they respected me enough to tell me, yo, you know, you cuss too much.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a year, man, where I had to do a 25 push-ups for every curse word, which prepared me for law school because you can't curse in at Yale Law School.
Oh, yeah.
So all of those push-ups prepared me also to be eloquent in a way. And what I mean to say is that the men around me weren't just affirming. You know, they demanded something of me. And it was violence there, and it was insanity, and it was absurdity. But it was also a deep sense of expectation. And coming home, I think one of the things that has made my life feel the most fulfilled is that I know that in a very real way, like I've shown up. You know what I mean? I've shown up and people could say, yeah, I remember Shahid and his stories about why my life mattered that might not have happened had I not gone to prison.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Lowe's has the brand's pros trust to get the job done. You can now shop new Catalyst fencing solutions and save big when you do. 10% off when you buy in bulk. Plus, save $180 on a DeWalt 12-inch dual bevel sliding compound miter saw. Now just $449. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/6 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
You referred to yourself a couple times as Shahid.
Yeah.
Can you explain that to me?
Because when I got locked up, these guys, they were all talking and they sounded intelligent and also sounded righteous, you know?
Uh-huh.
And they were all practicing some form of Islam. And they were like, yo, if you could choose your own name too, who do you want to be? And the name was a function of becoming somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And so I chose a name. I already told myself I wanted to be a poet. And I chose this name, Shahid, because it meant the witness. But then I realized that, like, I was probably more afraid of surviving prison because somebody protected me. And this is naive and stupid, so just to be clear. But I was more afraid of surviving prison because somebody protected me than because I did it on my own with good fortune, luck. And I just couldn't bear praying to God to save me when I had picked up the pistol. And so I just could never be religious in that way. A lot of my friends were. I would fast during Ramadan. One year I had, my mentor was the head of the Christian community, the head of the Muslim community, and head of the Rastafari community. Yeah, I mean, I was a teenager, like still in mentorship time from all of these guys, you know? But I was just Shahid. And I was just Shahid because I was trying to find out why I was in prison. And I figured writer's job is to witness and to give testimony of what we've seen and what we've been through. And so I spent 8.5 years having everybody who cared about me call me Shahid and became a part of who I am.
Is it still? Do you still go by Shahid to some people?
Yeah, a few people. Some people I love. I mean, people who know me in prison, you know, but a couple people who love me. And it's an interesting thing in my life. You know, my woman, she called me Shahid, but it's interesting because I spent a lot of my life believing that the only people who care about Dwayne and Shahid are people who did time in prison. You know, I'll go to a prison and I'll be at a library opening and it's a prison where I did time. Everybody in the prison is calling me Shahid and everybody that's on that has never been in prison is calling me Dwayne. And it was so disconcerting the first time it happened, right? Because It happened all day, you know? And there's only one person who calls me both. And that's enough to make me feel like holding on to either one of those identities is not a refutation of the other one, you know, if that makes sense.
When it comes to holding on to those identities, I've dealt with a lot of people that have been in and out of prison over the years. And I always see one case I'm sure you're familiar with, that big case everybody's familiar with, is the West Memphis 3 case. And, you know, there was three defendants in that case that all got released. And I've gotten to know them all. And they all have a different kind of viewpoint in the way they live their life. They've been out now for 14 years. And it's like one of them, Damien, got out and he's like, that's in my past. I'm focused on my future and I'm moving on. And then Jason, sometimes I feel like is still in prison. He's still angry. He's still focused on that a lot. And then Jesse, it's like he came out and it was like he was never there. He like went right back into his life from when he was a teenager, when he went locked. So it was just interesting to see how different people. So I'm curious, like, do you still hang on to that identity of Shahid that was in prison that time? Or is that something you try to put behind you? It seems like you don't put it because you still work in that space so much.
I mean, it depends on like, identity is a fickle thing. I mean, Fernando Pessoa is this Portugal writer who created this thing called heteronyms. And he had all of these identities in his head, you know, and these people had like fully formed identities and back histories and backstories. And it was a weird way to say that sometimes the identity is a way, you know, people say like, well, you know, your nom de plume or your alias, right? Yeah. Your nickname. I mean, the way I think about it is that I went to prison 16 years old. And people I care about did 20, 30 years in prison. My opinion is that their life matters. whether they did 30 years or 50 years or 8 months. And so for me, if their 30 years matters, then how can I erase my 8? Like, what am I supposed to, I can't come home and pretend like that 8 years didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you were 20, something happened in your life that mattered. And I'm supposed to pretend like when I was 20, what happened in my life didn't matter? No, I refuse to do that because nothing was wrong with Shahid. Shahid was a part of the continuum that is Shahid sitting right here today talking to you. Like, I don't get to be me without all of those things. And I get it. I'm not burdened necessarily in a way that some people are. And I'm guilty. And I deal with the fact that I was guilty all of the time. So I'm not trying to run away from my guilt. I'm not trying to run away from my experience. And I recognize that my desire not to run away from it means that I wasn't broken by prison. I recognize all of those things. But I also know I wasn't broken by prison because people that I love or people that love me or people that just cared about me were in those prison cells too. And I have no desire to forget them. So it's my good fortune to be able to say that and to live that way. And I'm a writer, so I'm just going to abandon all of my content.
Like, yeah, right.
Like, be like, what do you write about, dude? I mean, I wish something interesting happened in your life.
Right.
Oh, me too. But I just have these bicycles to write about. But also, my thing is like, look, dude, like you got some people who they say that everything they write, you can write about the same subject every year. And that subject is not whatever you're talking about, but it is the world. And it is the lens under which by which you see the world. Whether you're writing about politics, whether you're writing crime novels, whether you're writing romance novels. This is why you could watch some films like it's like Sons of Anarchy. Like, how is this Shakespearean? And then you watch the Shakespeare play to this pattern after you're like, wow, this is Shakespearean. You know, and so for me, prison is just the lens under which I live my life. But where else is somebody like me going to be able to say I walked into a building with like 100 women and a white woman slightly older or slightly younger than me says, yo, they say Reginald Dwayne Betts is here and I just had to come shake your hand. I read Felon and then like fucking started crying. And it just said, I just wanted to say thank you. Like what kind of, I can't imagine walking away from the fact that prison has given me the substance by which I have built things that I've said that have touched, I mean, I touched people in ways that I didn't even dream of when I was becoming a human being I am. You know, people try to do this and fail. So for me, I couldn't imagine walking away from it because I like who I am and I like all of it. And more importantly, I like the people who only know me as Shahid, even if they ain't like me then. You know what I mean?
Right.
Even if they thought I talked too much. I like the fact that they could be like, man, I can see how this kid changed. Now, fortunately, most people like me, even if they thought I talked too much. But, you know. Mm-hmm.
When you went in, you were so young, you know, this story that's led to Freedom Reads, you spent some time in solitary confinement. How did you end up in solitary confinement?
I keep laughing. And people be like, he's so sinister. He laughs and then says he hurt somebody. He's like, no. I laugh because, like, you say something like solitary confinement and it feels like I deserved it. You know what I mean? I was 16 years old in a box that's smaller than my bathroom. And the first time I went to the hole, it's because I had wrote myself out of the block, which essentially was saying I was too afraid to be there. And then I felt like that made me a coward. So I told the CO when he came to move me, nah, I'm good. I'll just stay here. And then he was like, nah, if you either going or you going to the hole. So I grabbed his arm. I was like, well, I'll stay. I grabbed his arm. He said that was assault. I just like touched him. I didn't assault him. He slammed on the ground, dragged me down the steps, put me in handcuffs, and they gave me 10 days for assault. The second time a CO tried to slam me in the cell, because I had got ice for somebody when they said lockdown. And ice was like 20 steps from my cell. So I just got the ice before going into my cell. And she was like, I'm writing you up, bitch. You don't listen. And I'm like, well, if you write me up, I'm going to give me some ice too. And I was like, does anybody else want ice? And she was trying to close my door and I wouldn't let her close the door. And then she wrote me up and said, I hit her with the door. Now I'm saying, if you write me up for not letting you close the door, that's one thing. Because I didn't hit you with a door, right? And that's why I was in the hole and the second time. And then when I was in the hole the second time, the second time I was in the hole because somebody beat me up. I had bumped into somebody. They bumped into me, actually. And I was like, you could have said, excuse me. And then he beat me up, which is kind of messed up in a way when you think about it, right? It's like all I said was you could have said, excuse me. Why you start swinging on me? It was so discombobulating that I didn't understand that I was in a fight until the police broke it up. I shouldn't have shower shoes. I shouldn't have been walking to the shower with boxers on because prisons aren't safe places. But that was the second time. And then the third time was because of me not letting the CO close the door on me. Because I guess I felt like I was in a place where I wasn't protected and I was supposed to be disrespected all of the time. And I was just mad, you know, and I was just like, I'm doing what I want today. Ironically, I was getting ice for the Muslim and the Christian brother. but then I went to the home and they take all your books. And then I found out that the guys had set up an underground library because the one thing about prison is that we take care of each other when we can. And it might not be consistent and it might not be enough and it might not be acknowledged, but it happens. And so I was like, yo, somebody sent me a book and they slid Dudley Randall's The Black Poets under my cell door. And I discovered Robert Hayden, Sonia Sanchez, Lucille Clifton, Etheridge Knight in particular, because he had been to prison and he was writing about prison. And actually he was writing about a kid named Gerald. The first poem I read was called For Freckle-Faced Gerald. It said, with his precise speech and innocent grin, he couldn't quite win the trust or the fists of the young black cats around him. And then it goes on to talk about Gerald getting raped in prison. And, you know, I have been like remarkably loved, even in the worst of the shit, man. And when I read that poem, and I'm 17 years old in solitary confinement, and I understood that I knew I had something that Gerald didn't have. Like, even though I couldn't fight, even though I was fucking terrified, man, I knew that people liked me. And if I figured out how to care about people, I would be all right, you know? And part of having already chosen the name The Witness and thinking about what Etheridge did for this kid, I mean, sometimes you suffer so much that your life don't matter because you can't tell the story. How the fuck are you going to tell a story when you're living through something like that? I mean, literally, the pain just kind of completely erases you. And reading the work of somebody who decided to do that from a prison cell, I just said, I'm going to be a poet. Then I go to the next prison, Super Maximum Security Prison. I'm like, why am I here? I wrote them a request form. I said, listen, my points do not say I should be here. And they responded. My point said I was on level 4. The Supermax was level 6, Red Onion State Prison. They said, the fact that you're at Red Onion means that we are correct. But I get there though, right? And his brother said, hey, yo, Star, you look like a poet. I think you might like this book. And he gave me Every Shed I Ain't Sleep. And it was a book of post-World War II African-American poetry, an anthology. And that's when I found out that Etheridge Knight had served time in prison because the black poets didn't have biographies of the poets. It just had all of these just names in the poems, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he was also in Every Shed I Ain't Sleep. And so, you know, maybe they were right. I was there, which meant that I was meant to be there because if I hadn't gone there, I might not have had that extra information about the poet that had really made me feel like I could do this. You know, I knew he had been to prison because of how his poems were, but reading the story meant that he didn't like lie to people about having been to prison. It meant that he was able to exist as a poet, as a public poet, as a published public poet, and have the word incarceration within his biography. And despite what people think now with me or with others that's like me, that's now on television, that now write books, in 1996, this didn't exist, you know? So to read that in a book was like, oh, okay, I could be somebody, you know?
It's interesting, and this is just a little selfish for me. I'm reading a book right now by S.A. Cosby called Razorblade Tears.
Man, that shit's so good.
Yo, you read it?
Man, look, I'm in a prison. I'm in a fucking prison in Virginia, right? And mind you, so I read this book. This is Blacktop Wasteland, his first joint, right? But I read Blade Tears, too. But I read Blacktop Wasteland and I'm like, oh, damn, this is good. We got to put this in the Freedom Library. So I had already given like 1,000 of these books out to people in prisons all across the country through Freedom Reads. I go into a Virginia prison, right? This is the prison where everybody's calling me Shahid and then everybody else is calling me Dwayne. And so I'm walking around. I go in the cell block. This white cat with a straight trucker hat on, the brown coat. He with his crew of dudes is racially segregated. And prison ain't like some states, but still you got a little bit of that, right? But he's like, oh, man, my mom worked with this dude. And I look, I mean, he's excited in a way that you're not supposed to be excited in prison. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And he's holding up S.A. Cosby's book. And I just start smiling because I knew Cosby worked at Lowe's. The cat's mom worked at Lowe's. And, man, he was so delighted to find this book on the shelf. And then me and him talk. And then his mom wrote us a letter. But S.A. Cosby is an amazing writer. And I don't know what connection to incarceration is, but he always has characters.
And he mentions Red Onion Prison.
Yes.
In that book.
They've been locked up in places that I know. And what I love about it is they're still flawed, but they the kind of men that are just flawed and struggling to be better at this world and at this life. You know what I mean? Yeah, I never met that dude, man. But that story, I'll never forget that story, man. His mom wrote me and said, my son has never sounded like this since he's been locked up. Like, talk about the power of a book. And that ain't the power of me or Freedom Reads or none of that. I mean, some of it is, to be honest, not to be too, like, some of it is. But what it really is the power of narrative, of story, of, like, getting this work that S.A. Cosby created in the hands of somebody who would really connect to it, but also connect to it to a value possibility that he was able to connect to his mom. You know, it's like if S.A. Cosby goes from Lowe's to writing best-selling books, who amongst us can't? Which is just a beautiful idea to bring into a prison.
Yeah, I didn't know that about him. And now I'm even more, I'm like two-thirds of the way through it. And now I'm even more excited to finish reading that book.
It's a good book.
Have you read, this is our book club now, as was attorney. Have you read All Sinners Bleed? Is that one of his other books?
Yeah.
Another great one.
Yeah. And it's, I'm actually halfway through All Sinners Bleed. See, it's so good that I had stopped, man, because I was like, I don't know, man, I can't. These three siblings got to make it out okay.
Right. Yeah.
I had to split out because I was like, if somebody, I think when I was reading, I was at a state in my life where I don't want a fairy tale ending. I want a rich, complex book. But sometimes I just get enamored with the characters and I just need them to win. And I can't put that burden on a writer. So sometimes I'll be having to put a book down and be like, you know what? It's giving me a lot right now. I don't know if I could deal with it disappointing me. So I'm going to come back when I'm in a different emotional headspace and I could grapple with like what might be. Because that book, All Sinners Bleed, is so harrowing. You know, it's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny you say, because I'm in the exact same boat with Ike and Buddy Lee right now with Razorblade Tears. I'm just like, these guys got to be all right. They got to be all right.
Yeah. You're right. And you know, what's cool is we're talking about this and we've been talking about prison and we've been talking about these like complex legal issues. And now we're talking about like books, but we're talking about books that clearly are like deeply engaging, but it's a crime thriller.
You know, right.
He won the LA Times Book Award, which is also fantastic because he's one of these writers who has been able to like transcend genre, but he still is very much within a genre. He's a crime writer, and I love the fact that we both read a crime writer and one who believes in like. But you know what though, man? Actually, man, not for nothing. Crime writers have always believed that the redemptive qualities of the human spirit, the fact that we are capacious and could be more than one thing. It's just the rest of us who forget it. Maybe we should all read crime novels more.
Right.
We should just all read S.A. Cosby more.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Hey, you know what? I'm going to tell you one more cat. S.A. Chakraborty, just because it's another essay. And she's a sci-fi writer.
But okay.
She has this amazing trilogy of books that are essentially about a person who doesn't want to, basically, you could control somebody's whole being if you do something, right? And so this guy's a warrior and an evil person controls them for like 1,000 years and makes them become just like an evil scourge of the earth kind of killer. Right. So this happens. And then the books are called City of Brass, The Kingdom of Copper and The Empire of Gold. But by the end of the series and different moments of the series, this guy becomes a recognize who he was and what he's done. Right. But how do you make amends for what you've done and you had no control over that thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just such a powerful question that the book, because everybody, because look, you're not saying you didn't do it. And you have a reputation, so everybody knows you did it. And it sounds like an excuse to say you were controlled by somebody else, even if you actually were. And it's such a deeply powerful story because it makes me think about why I'm sometimes bothered about the conversations that we have about crime and violence. Like, I don't care about the societal conditions that made it more likely that I would end up in prison. Because those societal conditions have nothing to do with what I do with my life now. You know, much of the conversation is about like, maybe if I could convince the public that the United States is racist enough, they'll let my friends get out. Maybe if I convince the public that like, you know, the criminal justice system is, the judges are callous enough that the the prosecutors are cruel, that the plea bargaining system is bogus, that you will love me. But what does that have to do with what I did? You know what I mean? Particularly when I've done a lot of things, and I particularly haven't done a lot of things, but everybody that's coming out of prison, a lot of us are grappling with this. If I'm grappling with it and I haven't done a lot of things, I imagine that a lot of people are grappling with this. And this is the question that S.A. Chakraborty raises in this trilogy of books. I just hijacked your podcast, Bob. I'm sorry, man.
No, you didn't at all. I was just in your thing. I'm like, I'm so fucking bad at my job. I guess I should use this as a transition because I just want to sit and talk to you for the next 5 hours. But this is a good segue for my podcaster self to say, okay, so we're talking about books now. Now tell me, once you got out, you're 24, 25 years old, and then you start this journey, and that journey led you to all the way to Yale Law School, become a lawyer, a poet, a writer. Let's skip ahead since we had our book club in the middle there, and let's jump ahead to Freedom Reads. How does Freedom Reads come about, and what do you do?
And I mean, interestingly enough, it's still connected to everything that we've been talking about, because I had a history in prison that didn't help me get a job, that didn't help me build a foundation
right.
for life. And I came home at 24 and I was older than most of my peers. I went to undergrad. I got an MFA in poetry. I was attempting to get a job. I wrote some books and I couldn't get a job teaching. And I understand now that I could have got a job doing other things, but my brain jumps around and I'm really interested in a lot of different things. And I probably just had an incapability of sitting still. And desiring to be a professor is probably good for somebody like that because it gives you time to occupy your brain with other things that interest you. But I couldn't get a job and I got desperate and decided to go to law school because at the bare minimum, I wouldn't have to pay my student loans. And I thought that it's hard to distinguish yourself as a poet wanting to be a professor if you went to prison. But a lawyer wanting to be a public defender who's went to prison seems like I'll be able to get a job. And so I go to law school and I want to become a public defender. And I realize my homies are still in prison and they've been in prison for 20 years and they don't have public defenders. And that's not the work that public defenders do. And then my clients are going into prison and I'm having a hard time dealing with that. I'm having a hard time dealing with the people that I represent guaranteed to go to prison. And so I kind of said, I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to be a professor. And then I couldn't really do that. I was just failing at everything, you know, because I took too long to write and I was writing complicated things. I wanted to write for the New York Times Magazine, and some of my legal advisors and mentors thought that I was wasting my time by doing that. So I decided to do something else, which was to do a solo theater piece, which I had never done before in life. And I ended up getting some people to support that idea. And I probably did that because I wanted to help my friend Roger Fentress get out of prison. So I was doing a solo show about my life, but about the fact that he was innocent. And I was doing all of this thing to do it. And then he got out. But as I was sort of got the funding to do the solo show, somebody asked me, what would you do if money wasn't an issue? And they specifically were saying, what would you do for people that were in prison? Now, understand, I'm still in student housing. And at this point, I'm still in the PhD program. I'm basically ABD. So all I need to do is write my dissertation and then I could go on the job market. And the person says, what would you do if money wasn't an issue? And what would you do for people in prison? And suddenly, like, my life wasn't about trying to get a job and make money anymore. Like, I was just given permission to dream a dream that had nothing to do with how I'll pay the next bill. And I was like, well, we put millions of people in prison. I will put millions of books in prison. And I said, I would do it one library at a time. And then over the course of 6 to 8 months, I developed the concept of the Freedom Library. I partnered with Mass Design because I realized that if I wanted to make the bookcase, and this is the bookcase, it looks like this.
Okay.
But it's this is eighth scale. So it sits in like 2 by 6 feet of space. Mm-hmm. The book exists on each side. So 6 or 7 people could be around the library at one time and browse. But I spent like a year designing that because that doesn't exist in the world. And it didn't exist in the world before we did it. I spent the year primarily working with Mass Design, some architects there, but also with the DLC, designing it. And then, you know, once I had got the funding from the Mellon Foundation, we went from a design to a functional prototype to a pilot to 600 Freedom Libraries and, you know, across 16 states and 60 prisons. And it has been profound because we create this collection, a curated, specially curated collection that puts S.A. Cosby beside Faulkner, beside Bowen, beside Sonia Sanchez, you know, beside Don Quixote, beside like a wide range of literature. And it has been an amazing ride, but really it has been a culmination, I feel like, of what I have been working on since somebody slid the Black Poets under my cell door when I was 17 years old in solitary confinement, which is to give to others what was given to me.
It's incredible. And it's, well, there's three things I want to hit on before I wrap up. One is Freedom Reads a nonprofit. Is it somewhere people can donate to help you guys out?
See what I mean? You are great at this. I would not. So Freedom Reads is a nonprofit.
Okay.
They could donate. They could go to Freedom Reads, FreedomReads.org. And what's amazing, though, is that, you know, if you make a donation to Freedom Reads, you're helping us to put a beautifully curated collection of 500 brand new books on beautifully handmade wooden bookcases into spaces with, I mean, these women yesterday were weeping to have it, and they were laughing and they were joyous, and they all said, nobody comes and does something like this. And all of them said, thank you. And I said, you're not thanking me. You're thanking the people who donate. And one woman said, can I ask you a question before you leave? Can we donate? And that had me crying because, you know, I worked for 23 an hour in prison. And they were like, listen, we've been here for 20 years and nobody did anything like this. Can we add to what you're doing? And it reminded me of the first woman who donated $35 from a California prison to us. It reminded me of the dude that from Missouri who sent us $1,000 and said, man, I haven't felt free in like more than a dozen years, you know, and y'all came through and I've never felt this free. And this is all of the money I have to my name. Another guy, John J. Lennon, incarcerated in New York, he donated $10,000. And so I would encourage your listeners to donate because all those donations make this work happen far more than anything I say.
Absolutely. We'll put the link to do that in the description of this. The second thing, you mentioned your memoir a couple of times. What's the name of the memoir and how do we get a hold of it? For no other reason, because I want to read it.
Well, I would say two things, actually. Memoir is interesting. It's called A Question of Freedom. And that's because I called it the one of the essays I wrote in prison. It's called A Question of Freedom. And I wrote it when I was taking this writing class, contemplating how is it that I ended up in prison when all of the things pointed otherwise. And it came out, and you can find it on anywhere books are sold. So Barnes & Noble's, your local bookstore, Amazon. And if your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble's, doesn't have it, they could order it. It's readily available. But also, I've written at least two major pieces that I will point out to people. One about myself for the New York Times Magazine, Can a Comic Become a Lawyer? I intended to find out. And that sort of traces my life from incarceration to Yale Law School, which, you know, is a lot to put in one piece. But I won a National Magazine Award for it. And it was my first piece of long nonfiction. And it's a way for anybody who's interested to kind of get the memoir as written by a more mature writer. Because the memoir just covers prison also. So that gives you something that you can't get anywhere else. It's just the day I got locked and it ends the day I came home. But that is like the day I came home with some backstory about what got me in prison and then up to law school. And then I wrote another piece that I like to tell people about Kamala Harris called Kamala, My Mother and Me. And that came out the day before Election Day in 2020. And I think that was fascinating because I talk about myself. I talk about violence. I talk about the tension between freedom and violence because I talk about something that happened to my mom. She was a victim of a violent crime. And it was profound because I used Kamala Harris to really talk about these other issues. And then the last piece, I'll just tell you this and your viewers. This is the first time I've talked about this publicly. But I spent the last 5 years working on a piece about getting my gun rights back. I got my gun rights back in Virginia. I learned how to shoot. And I wrote an essay about what that meant and what, you know, picking up a gun out of sport and a desire to disconnect it from violence, like what that meant for me, what that made me think about. And I think it's a pretty interesting piece, just partly because I spent 5 years working on it. Also because gun ranges are interesting places and everything changes, actually, when you realize, one, how I realized how foolish I had been, but I also strangely like connected in a lot of ways to people at gun ranges that I haven't been able to people in the world. And it might just be them not needing to hear me tell them about my crimes and shit to trust me. That might just be it. Or it might just be that I could disappear at a gun range and just really like lose myself and just focus on trying to acquire skill. And it's allowed me to obsess over the learning part of my nature in a way that just has no fulfillment. There's not like a 2-year, 3-year end date to it, you know, for a whole lot of reasons, from the fact that I can't go every week to the fact that I still don't like guns that much and it's so difficult to do and all of that. But y'all should check that out. It'll be coming out in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, for sure. And that really interests me too, because there's some complexity and layering to that. Like you had the, you know, it was a gun that put you in prison.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely super interested in reading that as well. And then the last thing is you have a documentary that's about to come out as well too, right?
Yeah, it's kind of cool because, you know, we about to end, and it's weird to end on something like this. But I'll just say, as an artist, I found in my life, I've constantly been discovering who I am. And part of it is because I went to prison before I was formed. And I didn't have the chance to make the decisions that would have given me some grounding in it. But over the last 3 years, I've discovered that I'm bipolar, that I got really bad ADHD. I've gotten divorced. And me and my ex is amicable. It was my first girlfriend after prison. We were married for 16 years. But it was tough, as any divorce would be. And I was like extremely depressed. I mean, the apartment I'm in right now is the first apartment that I ever had as an adult by myself. And that in itself almost meant like I had two first moments of freedom, because you come home, and I came home and went to live with my mom. And then I ended up getting married. We had our own place and all of that, kids and all of that. But like now I got my own place. It like changes everything. And I'm a single dad, changes like everything. But the documentary was being produced during this time as well. And it was me putting in the hands of others permission to tell my story. And I'll be sending them footage of me kind of losing my mind. And they were interviewing people. And it's just actually a beautiful piece that I'm proud of, because I didn't control the picture of me. And sometimes you just want to know that somebody sees you and is not ashamed of the messiness that might be a public breakdown, you know, like. I might be breaking down in front of the courthouse at 3 a.m. or biking at 3 a.m. or whatever I'm doing to figure out how to sort my life out. It all comes out in the film. And to have it, you know, to have it premiere in Tribeca is like really dope. And then Brian Tyree Henry, he's the narrator of the joint. But it's beautiful because he's narrating my words, which is kind of dope, right? Because the whole story is built around my words. And I'm like, man, I've watched it. I'll be like, yo, that was sharp. They'd be like, you know, that's you. Wow, I said that. So it's kind of cool, too, because like whatever you think about me, you'll be affirmed or disaffirmed by watching. Mm-hmm. This is my words stitched together to tell the story about my life with interviews from my mom and a bunch of other people who care about me. So it's at Tribeca June 8th. And I believe that they're going to make so, because, you know, it's a whole country. The premiere ticket is already sold out, which is pretty dope. It went on sale yesterday. Yeah. And they're gone. But my son said, "Whoa, does that mean you famous?" I was like, "No, it means 150 people wanted to see the documentary."
But just tell them what I always tell my kids is, "Wow, I'm more famous than you are."
For real. but Tribeca just hit us up and they said that they're gonna make it like that. You could purchase it to watch it.
That's
like,
what I was wondering. Yeah,
like during the film festival weekend, as a way to get more people to be able to watch things that, you know, because the world is large, and why make the world just the local Tribeca thing? So that'd be great. So I'm going to send. They could get that information at the Tribeca Festival.
Excellent. So lots of ways to learn more about Dwayne. And buddy, I'm like, this has been fascinating. Most interesting conversation I've had in a long time. No offense to previous guests. But
you got to tell it. Well, some of your guests have been in prison, so I can't even say that. They'd be like, I was in prison too. What you mean?
Right. Right. But no, this has been absolutely fantastic. Listeners, check out, I'll have several links in the descriptions. I really highly recommend. I think Freedom Reads is such, and we just discussed this with some of the people we've been working with that we've been fighting to get out of prison who are wrongfully convicted, to where they're having issues where we're not allowed to send books to them anymore, and they're making it really difficult to send books to them, because we hear it from everybody, you know, who we work with, you know, that it's, if you want to send me something to read. And so this is a great way to help that cause at Freedom Reads. Dwayne, it's been, from the bottom of my heart, an absolute pleasure meeting you and talking to you. And I wish you just all the luck and blessings in the world moving forward.
And man, thank you for your time. And we stay connected, because next time, you know, when we go and do library openings, we do library openings to make them an event. So yesterday we were at Logan Correctional Center right outside of Chicago. We did 7 libraries. So what that meant is it was a team of 4 that went in. And sometimes we have people on the outside come in with us, right? So we go to each cell block. And each cell block, each one of these weighs 100 pounds. And so we had a U-Haul truck on the yard with 21 of these in the truck and 21 long benches in the truck. And we would have to stop at each cell block, carry each of these out, and the people that was inside would help us. So it would be 2 women per this. So we had like 7 volunteers helping us. And we would bring them inside and sort of stitch them together, and the 500 books will be in 13 boxes. We will open the boxes in community. We will put the boxes on the shelves in community and spend like 20 to 30 to 40 minutes on each sale block during that process and talking about books to people. But what's profound is that you see people in a different space. You see them as people. You see them as interested in books. You don't see them and think, what are you locked up for? And then at the end of that, we do an event and you get to see them enjoying a poetry reading or enjoying a novelist read from their work. So you should come in with us one time and I would love
to get
back. And you have, I mean, it is one of my only guarantees in life that somebody like you will do this and come away like, I just learned something about people I care about that I wouldn't have understood, because no other thing in society really lets you meet people who are in prison in those terms. So I would love to, I'm inviting you at your convenience to come inside with us.
100%. And I'll definitely do it. I'm down in, I'm not far from Chicago. I'm in Southwest Michigan, but I'm like right on the border by like South Bend, Indiana.
One of our homeboys, he came from Michigan. He drove U-Haul from Michigan. This guy named Seth that we work with, he drove the U-Haul from Michigan because he makes these by hand up in Michigan. We work with two satellite shops. They make libraries for us and then bring it to us because that's one of the ways that we get around the country more easily. And we are definitely going back to Chicago. I think we said at the end of May. So I will definitely keep you updated.
Sounds great. And again, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with me. I know this has been an awesome conversation. I know my listeners are gonna really enjoy it. And hopefully it results in a lot of donations for you guys. And for sure, let's stay in touch after this.
Cool, man. Thank you. Have a great day.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.